Hey there, and welcome to another episode of my weekly show. Not so weekly last week, but please forgive me, I was in Rome filming for my TV show, so I really didn't have the time nor the equipment to record a podcast, but I hope to compensate for that in today's show. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. This episode of the show is brought to you thanks to my patrons. They help me to do what I love doing, and that is to create content for you. If you want to join them, check it out over at patreon.com/FatherRoderick. And my patrons, if they support me on a monthly basis to as a thank you, I record for them a special podcast that only my patrons can listen to. More information on the Patreon page. Again, over at patreon.com/FatherRoderick.
You know what's going on? This is what's happening in your world.
Face it, Catholics rule. We got Boston, South America, the good part of Ireland, and we're making serious inroads in Mozambique, baby.
You've taken your first step into a larger world.
So this past week, I was in Rome. It was super hot. 35 degrees, 36 degrees on Friday. Celsius, that is. So that's 97, I think, Fahrenheit. Really hot. And running around with a camera, I'm so glad that this was the first time that I took the Canon M50 and the super lightweight carbon fiber tripod with me. So because of that, I survived. I don't know how I did this in the past with the Canon ATD. And even the Canon ATD was already a huge improvement over other cameras that colleagues of mine are using. But the Canon ATD is, including the lenses, is like 2.5-3 kilograms that you lug around. And also the tripod that I had was a lot heavier than this stuff. So it was really nice to try out this super tiny setup and yet being able to film 4 episodes of my TV show. If you want to hear more about that week in Rome, I won't bore you with that in this show because we've got a lot of to talk about, but check out the newest episode of The Walk over at Tridio.com. In other news, we finally have a place to go on vacation. This year we were extremely late, and when I say we, for those of you that are new, every year I go on vacation with 3 colleague priests. One is from my diocese, the other one lives and works in Luxembourg, and the other one is in the south of the country. We know each other from Rome. We go on vacation together since our time in Rome, and this year we've been just going back and forth and back and forth about where we wanted to go, which cottage we were going to rent, the weather, the costs of it. It was so much going back and forth. But finally, while I was in Rome, they decided where we are going and where we were going to go. And this year, and I'm super excited about it, it is going to be Ireland. We're finally, after more than 10 years or perhaps even 15 years, we're finally going back to one of my favorite countries, Ireland. We've rented a home in Fenagh in the Leitrim region. Again, butchering the words probably. Fenagh is F-E-N-A-G-H. So it's kind of a little bit above Dublin, and then all the way to the left. It's not far from the border with Northern Ireland, so it's kind of in the inlands. There are some lakes in the surroundings. From there, since we're pretty much in the center of Ireland, we can go both through the coast to the west coast. We can go to the east. We can visit Dublin. There are a lot of great places that we can visit. We can go to Knock, which is the famous place of pilgrimage in Ireland, although we've already been there twice, I think, now. Anyway, it's going to be just for 9 days. So it's a very short vacation. That way, I only have to be away from the parish for one weekend. But it is cool because...
You know what's going on.
Oops. I know what's going on. That was not the button I wanted to press. But it's great because I know that in Ireland, there's going to be a lot of cool stuff that I want to film. Last time that we were there, I only had a very ancient digital camera. Most of the photos that I took for today's standards look terrible, and I didn't film anything. Now I certainly will, so you can look forward to some interesting vlogs from Ireland. And who knows, perhaps even a documentary.
I do not like movies. they're predictable. Like, the guy gets the girl and that kid sees dead people and Darth Vader is Luke's father.
Not liking movies is like not liking puppies.
They're fine. I just get bored and never make it to the end.
You know, you need a movie education. You need a moviecation. I'm going to give it to you.
Daniel in the chat room wants to know, since he knows that I'm a Potter fan and a Star Wars fan, where do I stand on the MCU, the Marvel universe? Well, if you've been listening to the show for a while, and you can always go back and listen, for instance, to my review of the Avengers movies, you know that I'm a huge fan of Marvel. I just love what they did, both with the TV series and the comics and the movies. Not so much of the games. Most of the Marvel-based games are not very good. They're just the other week, I think they showed a preview of a video game that they are basing on the Avengers. And I think they made a capital mistake. They didn't use the likenesses of the actors. Instead, they gave all the characters that we know from the movies completely new faces. And apparently it's more kind of in line with what you would see in the comics. But releasing that game trailer so just a few months after the conclusion of that epic Marvel saga of the Avengers, I think was a stupid mistake. And now everybody's hating on the way these characters look, because they feel like family. We've been enjoying their adventures for more than 10 years, and all of a sudden they give us like other versions of these characters. I don't know what they were thinking. The game may be great, but I think in terms of marketing, that was a capital mistake. Anyway, talking about movies and TV shows, today I want to give you my initial impressions of a TV show that has been talked about a lot in the previous few weeks. It is an HBO miniseries. And it was launched, I think, right after the finale of Game of Thrones. So everybody was kind of pondering, should we renew our subscription to HBO now that Game of Thrones is over? Is it still worth it? And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we have this miniseries called Chernobyl, I should say. Chernobyl is based on the actual events that happened in, I think, 1986, if I'm not mistaken, of the nuclear disaster that happened in Chernobyl and the subsequent mistakes and even, you know, cover-ups and really grave errors that were made by the Russian people in responsible by the government, trying to at least PR-wise minimize what the perception of what was truly going on, which is a disaster of epic proportions, and that could have been so much worse. If you look at the what happened there, it's almost a miracle that that it was the disaster that it was, and it wasn't more something on a global scale. I do remember what happened there because I was finishing my exams at the time. I was in secondary school. I was 18 years old, I had just turned 18, and I'd already finished my exams. And all of a sudden, we get these rumors on TV that something terrible had happened in Russia, a nuclear plant. The United States had captured satellite footage. And everything indicated that it was a meltdown, an explosion at a nuclear power plant. And the first few days, we didn't get much more than that information. And all of a sudden, we get these warnings that we shouldn't go outside. All of a sudden, all the cows in the Netherlands were called in. They couldn't graze in the fields. It was, I think, in May, I think. So the weather was great. The cows were already in the fields. That's what they do after the winter is over. They had to be brought in. And for a while, we weren't even allowed to drink dairy products. And also, I remember that they were warning for specific types of vegetables that we shouldn't eat, especially lettuce, because it was absorbing the radioactive fallout that was brought in I think on the winds that were coming from the east at that time, and also in Germany, there were warnings. Even children had to stay inside. They were not allowed to play outside. And so that was really scary because we still, we didn't know what was going on. This was pre-internet, so we didn't have access to much information. The only thing that we heard was over the, you know, the usual channels, the TV and the radio channels. And of course, we didn't know what was truly going on. This series dramatizes the events of Chernobyl. In doing that, I think what they did really well is to recreate the looks of that of that era and of Russia at the time. It's even though the entire series is in English, it still feels very Russian. So probably a lot of special effects in recreating the world of Chernobyl. But they did it in such a way that it is invisible. You totally believe that it has been filmed on location. What they took creative license with is actually the event itself. I read a pretty extensive article from, I suppose, scientists that were watching the series, and they said they took issue with the way, especially the radiation fallout was depicted, almost as if it was a virus that was transmitted over the air, and that people shouldn't hug each other, shouldn't touch each other, as if radioactive or radiation and radiation poisoning was something that was contagious, whereas you have to be really in contact and you have to be close to the radioactive material to suffer the consequences of that. So in that respect, there were also some really improbable scenes, like in the second, or is it in the third episode, at one point they're trying to put out the fire first by dumping sand on top of the nuclear reactor, actually worsening the situation because this is not a regular fire, and then the core, or what remained of the core, would continue to heat up. That would cause the sand to melt, and it would turn into some type of lava, and that would hit water tanks underneath the reactor, which then would cause this massive explosion that would basically make part of Russia and some other countries, some neighboring countries, inhabitable for centuries. They averted that, but in that episode, they show one of those helicopters that is dumping sand on top of the reactor, and it flies into the smoke straight above the core, and then it just collapses. You see the entire helicopter like being almost as if an invisible hand is crunching it, and it falls from the sky. And even though there has been a helicopter accident, it was months later, and it was unrelated to the radiation. So there are moments like that where, well, it's not very realistic. However, what it does depict very well is how the people around the reactor are reacting to what's happening, and especially the system of cover-ups of, you know, we have to project power, we have to show the world that we're in charge, that this is just a minor incident, and then the consequences of that cover-up, and thousands of lives could have been spared had it not been for this cover-up, where they tried to minimize the news leaking out, and so they were not evacuating the cities in the vicinity, and so many, many people got cancer afterwards and died a premature death because of that, you know, information war basically that was going on. This was, of course, in the, you know, still in the time that Russia was a very closed system. I think the Eastern Germany was still separate from the rest of Germany. So a lot, of course, has changed since then. And also things that haven't changed. I mean, the current problems that we have with Russia are mostly linked to the way they manipulate information and also manipulate information streams. And now, of course, they're much more dangerous in the way they try to influence our democracy in Europe and in the United States and other countries to basically in a very cheap way still exert power on the rest of the world. A lot of the warfare has been moving away from weapons into weaponizing our communications channels, weaponizing social media. And that we're only at the beginning of understanding how to counteract that, how to protect ourselves from that. And in many ways, it's kind of a flaw in our entire system. We are so used to just sharing everything online, or trusting our data to companies that are not supervised and that are vulnerable in many ways. Look at Facebook, how vulnerable that is. Look at Google, how much power they have. And basically, our governments are kind of standing on the side. In Europe, they're trying to kind of control what's going on, and also making sure that the digital rights of the people that live here in Europe are not trampled and sold out. But we still have a long way to go. We really don't think of the risk when we're using this these social media and the internet. Just the other day, I read an article of someone who lost access to his Google account, I think, and to his YouTube account, and he lost 10 years of data, including all his photos, all his emails, documents, whatnot. And Google basically is unable to do anything or doesn't want to do anything. It's just one example of what can happen if your entire life is in the cloud. Who is protecting the cloud? Who is protecting us from the people that have access to the cloud? There are a lot of inherent dangers to, I think, the way that we're currently naively using social media. And of course, a country like Russia is taking advantage of it. And well, let's not be naive. United States, Europe, they're also doing the same probably to Russia's systems. We know what's happening in China and how much the government is using social media there to control people, how they're using facial recognition to have a stronghold on the entire society. So it's still the early days, I think, of this digital revolution. We're in the middle of it. We can't go back, of course, but there are still a lot of things that we have to learn as a society, as a culture, on how to live with this and how to protect, most of all, human dignity with all this open access to information. All right, let's just hope and pray for wisdom. So Chernobyl, haven't finished the entire series yet, but I'm very impressed. Storytelling is excellent, keeps me on the edge of my seat, and it's one of those, like, oh, I want to see one more episode. But I don't, because I need to get some sleep as well. All right, and with that, it is time for a visit to the Peculiar Bunch.
Catholics rock!
Here at the Peculiar Bunch, we're always happy to tell you everything you always wanted to know about Catholics and priests and popes, but you were afraid to ask.
Catholics can be a peculiar bunch. No meat on Friday.
No meat? What do they eat, light bulbs?
And today I want to talk about something that really caught my eye, and not just my eye, but the eyes of the world when it comes to news from the Vatican.
Man, you guys got more crazy rules than Blockbuster Video.
Now, as you know, priests in at least the Western Catholic Church are asked to live a life in celibacy. So it means you don't marry, you don't have a family, but you dedicate your life in chastity and in total availability to the Church, which in itself is, I think, a beautiful thing. It is a way to dedicate yourself to God. You live a relationship with God, if all goes well, of course. And I mean, you have to nourish that like any relationship. It is also a sacrifice, not in the sense that you're missing out on something, because there are many people that are not married and live a life of celibacy, even if they're not priests or monks or nuns. But it's a sacrifice in terms of you give your life away. And that's how I have always seen celibacy. It's a vocation within a vocation. However, it is a church rule. It has not always been like that. The apostles were married, at least most of them, and also during many centuries, priests were allowed to marry, and still they could work and live as a priest, and they were ordained. However, that changed in the Middle Ages when, mostly from within the church, people were asking more dedication of their priests. There were a lot of things. Some priests were not living, let's say, their married life in a way that leads to holiness. There were also problems with, well, lots of practical problems to linked to the fact that priests were married. And so, after long deliberation and prayer and debates, the church imposed celibacy for priests, bishops, and for the Pope, of course, who is also a bishop. Well, there have always been exceptions to this rule. For instance, there are churches, other traditions within the Catholic Church, linked to Rome and also part of the greater Catholic community, where priests have continued to basically have the choice between marrying and working as a married priest, or living a life in celibacy. Those two options have always been there in all Catholic churches. But then also the option of married priests exists in certain countries. And in more recent years, priests that were, for instance, ordained in the Anglican Church and converted back, you could say, to the Catholic Church, to the Roman Catholic Church, have in some cases been allowed to continue to work as a priest, even though they were married. And there is even a more interesting exception to the celibacy rule, and that is something that we know, and we have several people here in the Netherlands, one of my friends and colleagues in my own diocese, they used to work as Protestant pastors, and so they were married and worked as Protestant pastors in their community, converted to Catholicism, and were ordained priests with the permission to live life with their wives. So some of those priests have children, and yet they're still ordained regular Catholic priests. So it just goes to show that celibacy is not inherent to the priesthood. The fact that the Catholic Church only ordains men as priests, that is something that the Catholic Church considers to be inherent to the priesthood. The Catholic Church doesn't see any sign in the tradition from, let's say, the time of Christ himself to now that would allow us to ordain women, even though the church, fortunately, thankfully, is discovering more and more how important it is to involve women in high-ranking positions in the church. And Pope Francis is currently finally making lots of changes to make sure that that happens and that we get more women involved in the governance also of the church, which I'm all for. However, sacramental priesthood is something that is based on what Jesus did. And if Jesus didn't ordain, well, he didn't really ordain the apostles, but there was for the apostles, he only chose men, even though among his followers, there were a lot of very influential women. But he never appointed women as apostles. And so that is kind of the basis of the male priesthood in the Catholic Church. I know that in some other denominations they've made different choices, but this is how the Catholic Church kind of looks to this. However, and I'm coming to the point now, finally, after talking for 10 minutes, just this past week, there was news that in a Vatican document, an official document, which is preparing an upcoming summit of bishops in October in the Vatican. And that summit is going to discuss the pastoral needs in what they call the Pan-Amazon region. So this is countries like Bolivia, Brazil, Colombia, Ecuador, French Guinea, Peru, Suriname, and Venezuela. In those countries, there is a tremendous lack of priests. And it is so difficult to feed the Catholic communities, especially more in the inlands, that this document is proposing as one of the topics of discussion, shouldn't we open the priesthood to married men? And they are basing themselves on a practice that has existed in the past as well, in the history of the church, where the so-called viri probati, so the proven man, men that have proven themselves to live a stable family life, that are a little bit older, have experience, that sometimes in history the church has ordained these viri probati to be priests and to work as priests. And this document suggests that this could be a solution to the lack of priests in this pan-Amazon region. And I think that is a first, at least in recent church history, that an official working document mentions this as an option that should be discussed. And so reactions, of course, as you can imagine, are very, very diverse. There are a lot of people that are applauding this. Finally, the church is kind of opening up a little bit, going kind of more adapting to reality instead of just thinking in terms of ideals. And some people are very upset. This is the beginning of the end. You know, if we let go of celibacy, then the next thing is going to be that everyone here in Europe wants to be a married priest and married bishops and married popes. What are we going to do? Like the first lady in the Vatican. And then that is going to cascade into the church also foregoing other, you know, Orthodox theology, etc. So they see this as the beginning of the end of the world. Well, I always think in terms of the Catholic Church knows that she is guided by the Holy Spirit. And you always have to listen to the sign of times. And at the same time, you have to, you know, talk and think about this together and think theologically as well. But since celibacy is a church rule, that rule can change if the situation requires it. And what is a very important principle in church law that governs kind of the things that we do in the Catholic Church is that the pastoral good is always in the first place. What the church is and what the church does has to serve the pastoral needs of the flock. And from that perspective, if you then look at, for instance, the obligation of only choosing celibate men for the priesthood, if that rule endangers the flock, the pastoral needs of the flock, and you have to think about situations where there is only a mass like twice, three times per year because priests are traveling the huge, huge region and can only be in villages, you know, every so often, like a few times a year. And not just Mass, but also confession, the sacrament, the anointment of the sick, all the sacraments that are meant to be available to the flock, that are really important for their well-being, for their growth in faith. If you cannot provide those sacraments, if you cannot help those Catholic communities, and this is going on, this has been going on for years and years and years, and there's no improvement in sight, then something needs to be done. And that is why this is currently on the agenda of the bishops that are going to convene in October. Personally, I think that celibacy is a great gift for the church. It's definitely something that I've chosen with all my heart and that I believe to be very fruitful. But I also think that this is a discussion, a very good discussion to have. And I really hope that they will find a good solution for those very remote Catholic communities, that if we don't find a solution to the lack of priests in those areas, are going to perish, are going to die, and that's happening quite a bit in some of those countries in the Amazon region, that they kind of slowly change to Protestant communities because, well, Protestant pastors are often married and are much easier to find. So I think the Catholic Church is doing the right thing to think about that, to pray about that, and I don't really like the fear-mongering that is happening in some areas of the Catholic Church where they all think, oh, this is the beginning of the end. No, it's not. The church has been around for 2,000 years. It will be around for many more centuries to come. That is if we stay alive here on this planet with all the changes.
When did you become an expert in thermonuclear astrophysics?
Last night. The packet. The extraction theory papers. Am I the only one who did the reading?
I've done some more reading. First of all, I stopped reading Marvel Comics. Yes, I know. Really. I had a subscription to Marvel Unlimited. I've had that for 2 years, which enables you to basically read any Marvel comic book or any series that has been published since the beginning, since the dawn of time, or since the dawn of Marvel Comics, all the way up until today. It's only lacking, let's say, the last 6 months of comic books. But since I was very new to the world of Marvel Comics, there was still a huge mountain of comics for me to enjoy and to discover. I have to say, I've been reading some of those comics on my iPad. I really enjoyed the way that they programmed that app, because you can read an entire page, but of course on an iPad that's still very, very small. But then they also have this system where you go from panel to panel, so it's guided reading, and it's really well done, and it makes you appreciate the art so much more if you could go from panel to panel. However, they were just hiking up the price every year, and they were also renewing my subscription without really warning me in advance. And of course, you should always put the expiration date in your calendar, but yeah, I forgot. And then, you know, the price went up to 60, and I think the last warning that I got was that it was going up to 70, almost 70 bucks. I'm like, really? I read a comic like once every 2 weeks. I cannot justify paying so much money per year for a service that I barely use. So I decided to stop the subscription. I also ended some other subscriptions. Sometimes you have these digital subscriptions and you forget that you have them and that you're paying for them. So I canceled, for instance, Google Play Music. And I'm only listening to Spotify, the free version. I don't really mind the advertisements. And I have limited time to listen to music anyway. And so I'm saving almost 20 bucks per month now, thanks to a few subscriptions that I canceled. And with those 20 bucks, I can do other subscriptions. I can invest that into, I don't know, my Lego stream or something like that. And so I'm always kind of juggling with that. So I stopped reading the comics, the Marvel comics, and I will still continue to enjoy the Marvel universe. For instance, you know, Jessica Jones now has the third season on Netflix. I still have to see Iron Fist. I have to watch what was the other one? Daredevil, third season. I haven't seen that yet. So there's still a lot of Marvel around on Netflix that I can check out. And of course, hoping and waiting for Disney Plus to finally launch over here in Europe. We may have to wait until next year, but of course that is going to, again, make so much Marvel stuff available to the subscribers that I don't think I will get starved anytime soon. In other reading news, I've started to read the second tome, the second book in the Wheel of Time series by Jordan, what's his name? Robert Jordan. The book is from 1990. So I think I just entered seminary at the time. I think I started to study theology at the time. But back then I didn't read any fantasy books. And it's 50 chapters long, so it's kind of the same size as book number one. It's very fast-paced. But it has the same flaw as the first book. It starts with this confusing prologue, and I really don't understand why the writer chose to do that, because you're kind of getting a glimpse of the meta story that's going on, you know, like the big mythology under is in the backdrop, in the background of the adventures of our actual protagonists. But it's so, you don't really know that mythology yet. And so it's so really confusing. And it's like, why? It took me 5 tries to start reading this second book. And I had the same experience with the first book. It's so off-putting, these prologues. Anyway, it's a bit like the prologue not The Hobbit, but The Lord of the Rings. But in The Lord of the Rings, it is a very well-told story, whereas here you're in the middle of something and you're like all these dark figures and what the heck is going on? And why do I have to keep reading this for page after page after page? Just bring back my heroes. That's who I want to follow. I assume that once I've read more of these books, I will start to understand a little bit more what's going on, especially the dark side of that universe that Robert Jordan created. But for now, this is really off-putting. So I'm glad I'm now back to the group of people that I've invested in the first book and following their adventures. So it's a really fun, fast-paced book. It's a chase. It transforms into a heist. It's good. It's very enjoyable, and well, of course, it's a lot easier now to follow what's going on because I already feel that I know all the main characters from the first book. So I'll let you know when I finish this second book. Still a lot of books to go. I think 12 more books to go. This is definitely the biggest reading project that I've ever undertaken. But, well, I like myself. I like a challenge from time to time. All right, we need to talk about science fiction. Oh, I forgot to mention one more book. Jim Gaffigan, a Catholic comedian, wrote a book called Food, A Love Story. And it's hilarious. It was on sale on the Amazon Kindle store in the U.S. I've already read it, so I didn't buy it, but it's very enjoyable. Check that out. It's Food, A Love Story by Jim Gaffigan. Highly recommend it.
I see aliens. Little aliens from outer space.
And how are things in outer Plutonia?
How many times have I told you not to wear your space boots in the house?
Go to shape. I'm in. You can donate my body to science fiction.
Get your suit on! We need ya!
Wow. So much going on in the world of science fiction this past week while I was in Rome. The most remarkable story, of course, was the discovery of the Star Trek logo on the surface of Mars. I'm not kidding you. If you've missed this, you've been probably living under a rock, or you were in Rome just like I was. But apparently NASA photographed a sand dune that from up above looks right exactly like the classic original Star Trek logo, which of course immediately prompted some people to make the classic Star Trek versus Star Wars comparison. And of course, one of those people is William Shatner, Captain Kirk himself, who at replied on Twitter, "Hey, Star Wars, will you hurry up, rebel scums? We beat you!" And then links to the CNN story about this sand dune. And then, of course, who is going to react? None other than Luke Skywalker himself, actor Mark Hamill. And he says, "Well, looks like a boomerang to me." Meh. And then William Shatner is like, "Well, don't be jelly, Mark." And then there are some more back and forth between William Shatner and Mark Hamill. I love these Twitter fitties. It's so funny. And it's great to see that both the hero of Star Trek, you know, Shatner, and, well, kind of the token actor from Star Wars, Mark Hamill, are just, you know, being so humorous on the web. The sand dune itself, of course, is totally natural. Scientists from the University of Arizona explains that the curious chevron shapes are footprints of old sand dunes. They are the result of a complex story of dunes, lava, and wind. A long time ago, there were large crescent-shaped dunes that moved across this area. And at some point, there was an eruption. The lava flowed out over the plain and around the dunes, but not over them. The lava solidified, but these dunes still stuck up like islands. However, they were still just dunes, and the wind continued to blow. Eventually, the sand piles that were The dunes migrated away, leaving these footprints in the lava plain. These are also called dune casts and record the presence of dunes that were surrounded by lava. So it is really funny to discover that. And, well, maybe there was something visionary about the design of that Star Trek logo. It's still so iconic, so simple, and yet so recognizable. And, of course, it's the best ever promotion of the upcoming, you know, new season of Star Trek Discovery. So very, very clever. Also, in, well, let's go to Star Wars. Now that we've talked about Star Trek, I've got to keep balance in the Force. There are very exciting rumors about a third live-action TV series based on Star Wars. Of course, we already heard about The Mandalorian. That one is finished. The first season is already finished. So they're currently working on the VFX, and then that's going to air, that's going to premiere as one of the first series, the first new series that you get when you subscribe to Disney Plus. And there is also the Cassian Andor series based on the characters that we saw in Rogue One, this great, great Star Wars in-between movie. This is going to be a prequel, so it shows you the same actors, but it shows you what led up to the story of Rogue One. That is the second series, doesn't have a name yet, so that may actually premiere later, perhaps next year. But then Bob Iger mentioned that there is a live action series, another live action series in development. And rumor has it that this will be a series that will bring back Obi-Wan Kenobi. And playing Obi-Wan Kenobi, actor Ewan McGregor. And the Ewan McGregor will, according to this rumor, redon the robes of the Jedi Master that trained Anakin, and ultimately also kind of failed training Anakin, and will show his further adventures. And that is going to be so interesting, because Ewan McGregor is now older than Sir Alec Guinness when he played Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars 4. Now, of course, he looks a lot younger, is much more fit and in shape. One of the problems that they had, of course, with Alec Guinness is that he wasn't a physical actor. So that's why the famous encounter between him and Darth Vader looks so stilted, because according to George Lucas, both are old men, and so they don't have the same energy that younger Jedi had in the golden days of the Jedi Order. But I assume, well, I'm almost certain that this is going to take place. This series is going to take place in between the prequels and A New Hope. So, and there's still so many stories that you could tell, and it's a very familiar era. That we've already seen some of the animated series taking place in that in-between time. So there's already an established canon that they can build upon. Also, Obi-Wan is was in the Clone Wars, but didn't he also show up in Rebels, Star Wars Rebels? I'm not sure. Anyway, there's a lot of hype around this, and the Star Wars community has been abuzz with this rumor. And even before that, like, bring back Ewan McGregor. And all the memes, all the Star Wars memes, kind of center on Obi-Wan Kenobi. So he's a very popular character. And I'm sure that if this is true, this is going to be another really great asset for Disney Plus and a must-see series for anyone who likes Star Wars. So I'm here's hoping that this is more than just a rumor. And finally, when it comes to science fiction, last time in this podcast, I reviewed the Dark Tower movie, which to my surprise was directed by Ron Howard, a great director, definitely the director that I think saved the Solo movie. But the Dark Tower movie was a mess. It was really terrible, and maybe it was because of his involvement in Star Wars that he just didn't have time to deliver for the Dark Tower. But for a lot of fans of the franchise, of the book series by Stephen King, the movie was a huge disappointment. Well, there may be redemption for them, because apparently Amazon is filming the pilot of a reboot of the Dark Tower series, but this time as a TV show. And hopefully the TV show will be a lot better. I think Amazon really needs some big franchises now. Of course, they're preparing the Lord of the Rings prequels in a certain way, the Middle Earth series that will take place in the Second Age in Middle Earth, that is probably going to be one of the main reasons for people to stay subscribed to Amazon Prime. But I've been a subscriber to Amazon Prime in the Netherlands for 2 years now, and I really have to say it is not worth it. It is so shallow what they have in terms of movies. Now, even some of the movies that they feature are also on Netflix in the Netherlands. So why would people even stay subscribed to Amazon Prime? A lot of their own series are kind of so-so, not very, at least not really my taste. They've got Mr. Robot. Okay, that's fine. They've got The Man in the High Castle. That's okay. But none of it is really like must-see content. So I'll just stay subscribed because it's also giving me, you know, free, what is it, free delivery from Germany. So I make my money back. But in terms of like the deal that you get in the United States, for instance, if you're an Amazon Prime member, it's two planets. It is so minimal. And I'm pretty sure that Amazon Prime TV has almost no subscribers here in the Netherlands, or almost no one is watching it. So hopefully Amazon will pick up the pace or will deliver a little bit more in the near future.
We are on the cutting edge of technology.
Wow. Well, what does that mean?
Let's plug it in. It's going to say, hey, I see you plugged in a new device. And it's going to load in the appropriate drivers. You'll notice that this scanner build... Whoa.
Well, all your technology stuff just ends in disaster.
But there is one more thing.
I want to wrap up the show with the tech segment, and this week I want to talk a little bit about the ways in which I try to up my streaming game. Now, if you've been following me a little bit on social media, you know that I have really dive. How do you say that? To dive? I've diven. what is a past tense of to dive? I dived into the world of YouTube streaming and Facebook streaming. First, I started with Facebook streaming, then I switched to YouTube, then I dabbled into Twitch, and I'm currently looking into ways to stream to multiple platforms. I've even opened a Mixer account, which is a Microsoft gaming streaming service. So I'm going to experiment a little bit more with that later today because, well, there is an interest in definitely in the LEGO series. People really like to see me build LEGO LEGO sets. It calms them down. There was even someone in the YouTube community suggesting that I do an ASMR LEGO video. I'm not sure if you know what ASMR is, but it's the type of videos that I think are meant to really calm down people that during the day are so bombarded with impressions, with sound, with visuals. And so a lot of these YouTube videos are just people like whispering in the microphone, or they make sounds. They will just take a piece of plastic or, I don't know, like a bunch of keys, and they will just do this. Like, this is my keys that you're hearing. And that goes on for 5 minutes. And apparently that, actually it does, that makes me relaxed as well. So like, you could do ASMR LEGO. So I'm still on the fence with that because it's not really my style. I like to chat. Maybe I'm not there yet. I'm not calm enough myself to do that. But I can imagine that that could be, you know, relaxing. And just seeing someone who is not overacting like you see a lot on YouTube. There are a lot of people that are just like, hey, you're watching my YouTube video. So cool. And my peeps are watching. And subscribe here. And blah, blah. Well, almost after 5 seconds, I click to the next video. I really don't like that style on YouTube. So, I'm an old guy. So I'm a lot calmer. And apparently, some people enjoy that. But I want to up my game a little bit. I want to improve now that I've started to gather a small community on YouTube and also on Twitch. I want to get better at this. And the first step that I took was to improve the camera on my LEGO streams. So I was streaming initially with just my webcam, and not even the most recent one, not the Brio, the Logitech Brio that I have here in the studio, but the Logitech, what was it called? Anyway, it's just an HD webcam that I bought 3 years ago, and it's fine. It works fine, but of course, white balance, sharpness, it's not that good. Can't zoom in with it. And I was using the built-in camera on the MacBook Air 11-inch for like the insert where people can see my face while I'm building Lego. And that camera is horrible. Oh, what was Apple thinking, putting these type of really terrible cameras in their MacBooks? It's clearly just aimed to people that use their MacBook for video conferencing. But nowadays, people really want to deliver high-quality video to YouTube, and, well, Apple has not really given us the cameras that you need for that. So, and I've been building Poe Dameron's X-Wing Fighter, which is an awesome Lego set. It's the first X-Wing fighter that we see in The Force Awakens, you know, the black one with the orange stripes that he tries to jump into to escape from Kylo Ren's troops. And then, of course, the stormtroopers blow it up. Well, that X-Wing fighter, I'm building it currently. It's a really great build. Looks beautiful. And I use the Canon M50 that I'm also using to stream my podcast, and the kit lens to be able to zoom in. And it looks gorgeous. You know, you got the shallow depth of field. You really can get close to the hands on the table while I'm doing that. The colors, of course, are much more reliable and much nicer than what a webcam can show. And so I really want to continue using that as a Canon camera. The thing is, I'm using the M50 for my TV work, and it has to be here in the studio, and so I can't have it. I don't want to mount it every night when I want to do my Lego show. So temporarily, tonight, I'm going to try to use my old ATD, which is also a Canon camera, with the kit lens there, and see what that does. The advantage is that nowadays, you can hook up the Canon cameras to the Mac. It's only Mac only. You can't do that on a PC. And the streaming software that I use, Ecamm, is able to read the video image from the camera, straight from the USB port. It's amazing. I don't know how they do it, but it works, and it works really well. And for the past 10 episodes, I've been using the M50 to stream these shows live on YouTube, and it looks so much better. It even has a little bit of the background blur, and I really think that if I want to build the community around those Lego streams, I need to improve the camera. So trying out the Canon ATD. Another thing that I want to improve I've been starting to do video games on Twitch, which is also a streaming platform. That one's owned by Amazon, and Twitch is a really great place if you want to check out a game and you don't own it yourself, or you want to see someone who's really good at a game, or in my case, if you want to see someone who's a Catholic priest who's really bad at any game he plays, watch me on Twitch. Just look for Pixel Priest. And you can feel great about your own gaming capabilities, because I will show you that I'm always worse at a video game, no matter what video game, than you are. So it's really feel-good TV. However, I was capturing the games on my PC, and also using a webcam for the insert. That is not so. I'm not looking for a replacement of that, because, you know, it's just a tiny little insert in over the gaming video. So I think for now the webcam is fine. However, what was really bad was the audio. So Inge gifted me a gaming headset a while ago, a couple of years ago for my birthday, I think. And it was the Logitech G231 or the G231. It's a great headset. It's gotten a really nice look. It's plastic with orange and gray accents. And the audio is surprisingly good. It's a closed system, and it's got a little microphone. And it's plug and play. You just plug it into the audio and microphone in and outputs of your PC. And it works out of the box. No need to install drivers. The downside of that headset is that the actual audio that it captures is really low-grade you know, gaming audio. And if you watch a lot of streams on Twitch or on YouTube, gaming streams, you will recognize the sound.
It's like a very thin sound, like, I don't think I'm going here to the right, or no, low.
It sounds like a telephone. And in addition, Logitech has a bad reputation when it comes to what they call the noise floor. So there's a lot of static noise in the audio that is captured by that gaming headset. So you hear a lot of shh in the background. And since I want to do this in a professional way, I want people to really enjoy. That's why I'm using a pretty expensive microphone for this podcast, because I know that it improves the audio. And then in addition, with the Rodecaster, I'm applying all sorts of filters. Let me see what... there are a lot of things that are currently... like, I'm using a compressor. I'm using a de-esser, so all the S's are kind of toned down a little bit, so it's not grating when you're wearing headphones. It uses a high-pass filter. It also uses an aural exciter and some more processing. It even adds more bass to my voice. And I can show you the difference. So this is what you're hearing now. Sounds like a bit like radio. Well, here's what happens when I remove all those effects. It's a tremendous difference. Turning off the aural exciter, processing, the big bottom. So this is what the microphone sounds like out of the box. You hear the difference? Now I'm going to turn everything back on. So big bottom first, or processing, here we go. So that is a little bit more bassy than the aural exciter. So that is a very big difference. This is kind of a radio processing. But it can even get better. Turn on the de-esser. And then the compressor. The compressor makes a huge difference. So this is compressor on, and this is compressor off. On and off, off, on. So anyway, I wanted to have similar sound when I'm doing my gaming videos. And so I was looking for a good gaming headset, and surprisingly, it's hard to find good gaming headsets. All the ones that are, you know, 60, 70 bucks, which I consider to be pretty expensive for a headphone, they all have that same high noise floor, thin sound. I wanted to go to the next level with this. And so knowing that I'm very happy with this Beyerdynamic set of headphones that I use for podcasting, and those are the headphones that you see in my Star Wars reaction videos. So it's a Beyerdynamic 770, I think. Let me look at the... yeah, it's the DT77 Pro. It was really, really good audio. I noticed that Beyerdynamic also has a gaming headset. Only one. And it is called the MMX 300, second generation. Very expensive headset. If you buy it new, costs almost 300 euros. 300 euros. That is very expensive. However, in return for that, you get the best sound available. This is definitely audio-wise the best headphone on the market, period. So it's got the same quality, perhaps even better than the 77 that I'm currently using. But what is more important to me is the microphone is studio quality. I've heard some samples, and it sounds like this. It sounds exactly like this microphone that I'm using for podcasting. And audio is so important to how you experience something that you watch, even on TV. Audio is sometimes more important than video quality. So I looked around, and what I usually do when something is a little bit out of my league, or it's like $300 for just a headset, that's too expensive, I just go and follow the headset on Amazon. And lo and behold, this morning, I saw a secondhand version, but it stated it was as new, so it means it's been returned. So they probably opened the box and then, too expensive or not my color, and send it back. So it's never been used, but it takes $70 off. So I picked this one up for 230, I think. And it's arriving next week, so I can't wait to use that. And I know it is still extremely expensive. However, I've been using Sony headsets, a Sony headset for 10 years. And I bought it, I think, when I was still in my first parish. And it still lasts. It lasts so long. And the only thing that started, so audio-wise, it's still fantastic. So if you then look at how many years you can enjoy a headset like that and then spread the investment over all those years, then it's actually a very good investment. These biodynamics are even better because the material, there is a cloth material over the shells, is that how you call them? So the actual things that go over your ear, you can take them off and you can wash them. And you can buy everything on these headsets is replaceable, which is not the case with the cheaper headsets. Once something breaks, like a cable, it's broken and you have to buy a new headset. With Biodynamic, everything, including the cables, can be replaced. So you only have to pay for the broken element. And then the washable ear cloth stuff, all that, I think it makes this a good investment. But, of course, the proof is in the pudding. So you have to start following me on both on YouTube and on Twitch if you're interested in seeing a priest playing video games. And then you can see for yourself. With that, I think it's almost time to wrap things up. There's one last thing that I tried out. It's a speed booster for the Canon M50. For those of you, it's a very technical thingy. But it's a little insert in between the big lenses, for instance, for the 80D, and then the small Canon M50. And it enables you to capture a larger field of view and to get an extra stop of light. So check that out if you have an M50 and want to improve it. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Take care and God bless.